Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Joel Fuhrman. If you want excellent nutrition, if you want to not just prevent disease, but also to optimize your health, you're going to love this interview. Dr. Joel Fuhrman is a New York Times best-selling author, a family physician, and a researcher who specializes in reversing disease through excellent nutrition. Dr. Fuhrman's hugely successful PBS television shows, Three Steps to Incredible Health and Dr. Fuhrman's Immunity Solution, have brought nutritional science to many, many millions of homes across America and around the world. He's the million-copy best-selling author of Eat to Live, Super Immunity, The End of Diabetes, The Eat to Live Cookbook, and his latest book, The End of Dieting. Dr. Fuhrman is Research Director of the Nutritional Research Foundation and a member of the Dr. Oz Show Medical Advisory Board. So now, Dr. Fuhrman, we are so excited for this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Joel, for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm excited to talk to you. I had a lot of fun with you guys in the past. I'm looking forward to it.
One thing that always stands out for me whenever we converse is that so many doctors and other health professionals today will tell me that the medical profession has become so stressful and so emotionally unrewarding that they would not want their children to follow in their footsteps and become doctors. But you, on the other hand, seem to be greatly enjoying the practice of medicine. Why is that, and what gives you the most satisfaction in your professional life?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's a good point and an interesting question. But, you know, the thing is that makes, I think, what I'm doing a little unique is that I went to medical school 30 years ago with the intention to be a physician specializing in nutritional medicine, utilizing nutritional excellence as the foundation of my medical career. So I even attended medical school with that idea already in mind, because I remember thinking when I was, you know, a teenager in my young 20s that how ridiculous it seemed like to be a physician where people are abusing themselves with their lifestyle, predominantly with food, and then they're going to doctors to expect to take drugs that we know are toxic and put poisons and toxins onto the body that's already been poisoned and hurt by the bad diet, and how could that lead to wellness and good health? You know, and I really decided to go to medical school to try to make things different, to do things differently and offer a different alternative for people. And, you know, it's been tremendously rewarding, and I've seen over the last 30 years so many doctors that you're talking about that are dissatisfied with their career and been unhappy seeing people get sicker and sicker, heavier, requiring more medications, and, you know, and not really feeling they're the healers and they're really helping people. You know, when we were young in medical school, we were all idealistic. We felt we could help people. And then the doctors come out and they realize they're not getting results. People aren't getting better. They're just prescribing one drug after another. And actually, the more we investigate and see the studies come out in recent years, we find out that most of what doctors do to treat chronic diseases doesn't really help much, and in many cases can make things worse. And we're talking about giving people medications for blood pressure, for diabetes, for high cholesterol, sending them to cardiologists or interventionists for angioplasty or bypass surgery. We're finding out that nutrition works so much more effectively at giving people the option, the opportunity to get well. And I say that without the knowledge and the real education with how futile some of the medications are, and they're really a true in-depth look at their side effects, and until the patient really understands the limitations of these procedures and what doctors do, they're really not getting adequate informed consent to make a decision as to what they should do. And that leads many to think that drugs and surgeries can do more than they really can do for people, and it's a disservice to people. So the patient winds up unsatisfied, the doctor is unsatisfied, and we're seeing obviously a small change here, because I see every day more and more physicians moving and incorporating nutrition more and more into their practice and realizing that teaching, educating, and motivating patients is the way to go.
It's common for people today to believe that they have to live the rest of their lives either in pain or on medication or both. You've said that in very many cases it's possible to reverse disease, reduce high blood pressure, lose unwanted weight, prevent heart disease and cancer. all without relying on either drugs or fad diets. What are the basic principles of the nutritarian approach that you teach?
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate that, because two things you're just stating is, number one, that the conventional approach to disease, like most common diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol and heart disease, doesn't work very well, and those people still deteriorate and progress and eventually die of heart disease, still the number one cause of death in America, and we don't have an effective solution for the cancer epidemic. And nutrition and the modern advances in nutritional science is the real answer. And it also is the real answer for most of the chronic illnesses, including autoimmune conditions it's very effective for. So, you know, my 25 years as an experienced physician has demonstrated that nutritional interventions are not just safer, but they're more effective, and they work. And our population has to be aware of, you know, they deserve to know of this. I think the second part of your question, besides the fact that this is more effective, is what are the basic principles of the nutritarian approach that I utilize to get the beneficial response. And there are basically four principles of my approach. Number one is I want people to eat a diet that's high in micronutrients, and especially high in micronutrients per calorie. That's also referred to as nutrient density. We want people to eat a diet that has an adequate nutrient density. And that means to do that, you have to eat foods that have a high level of naturally occurring micronutrients and phytochemicals and antioxidants, like green vegetables and berries and, you know, and mushrooms and onions and tomatoes. In other words, we want people to eat high-nutrient natural foods. And, of course, we want them to reduce or eliminate foods that are mostly empty calories, that give us calories with no significant nutrient load. And people should be aware, and they are aware, I think, that processed foods and highly refined foods like white sugar and flour and agave nectar and oils and white flour pasta, that they are aware, I think, that these highly processed foods, soda chips, crackers, cookies, rice cakes, breakfast bars, breakfast cereals, are low-nutrient, empty-calorie foods and have to be eliminated or reduced if we want to have excellent health. So that's the first principle. Eat more high-nutrient foods, less low-nutrient foods. The second principle I call comprehensive nutrient adequacy, CNA. And that means that we can't just have a person eating a lot of broccoli and kale and tomatoes and think they're going to have good health, because they might not get the broad spectrum of nutrients that people require for their health. The diet might be nutrient-rich, but their weaknesses could occur from not getting everything that humans need. They could be low in vitamin D, they could be low in iodine, they could be low in zinc, they could be low in DHA. So we're making sure that people have adequate of everything they need, and these individual requirements may differ somewhat from person to person. So sometimes a blood test can help us evaluate whether a person needs more of something or something else. So the second big thing is CNA means make sure we're not missing anything we need. The third principle, of course, is our diet has to be hormonally favorable. And that means that we don't want to eat a diet with a high glycemic load that could raise our insulin response, because insulin doesn't just cause us to gain weight. It can increase our risk of cancer because it's angiogenesis promoting, which means it promotes the growth of blood vessels that can fuel the fat on the body and can also fuel cancer growth. And also high levels of insulin and high glycemic foods have other problems associated with them, like promoting advanced glycation end products and promoting cellular replication. And in other words, it's hormonally unfavorable for both cardiovascular disease and for cancer and for aging. And the other hormone we talk about, multiple hormones here we want to be favorable, another hormone we want to be in the relatively low range is IGF-1, which stands for insulin-like growth factor 1. For a diet to be hormonally favorable, it has to be relatively low in protein, particularly we're talking about low in animal protein, because plant proteins do not elevate IGF-1 into unfavorable ranges, as do animal proteins. And with excess amounts of IGF-1, it impairs the ability of the cell to repair DNA damage that can lead to cancer. And the fourth principle, I know it's taken a long time to get through these principles, but you asked, and the fourth principle is very simple. It just means avoid foods that are high in toxins. Toxins could be chemicals or infectious agents, parasites, microbes that could be harmful. You know, avoid things that have harmful elements in them. That's pretty obvious. We don't want to take in some kind of food that can have a parasite in it. We don't want to eat foods that are chemically contaminated. Like, for example, a person might go out to eat to a restaurant and they go, oh, well, what should I have here? You know, they have a macaroni and cheese dish. You know, here's a piece of some chicken, and here's a salmon dish, and there's a vegetarian. What should I eat here? And the person thinks, oh, I'll get the salmon, because that's probably the healthiest form of, if I'm going to have a little animal protein a couple times a week, that's probably the healthiest form to eat the salmon. Has a good reputation. But they're not recognizing that commercially raised salmon, farm-raised salmon, usually has 10 times the PCBs and dioxin levels compared to other animal products. And we have to consider that. So that's an element that could be throwing a monkey wrench into a person's health, not really as they're exposing themselves to toxic levels of certain disease-causing agents. So those are the four basic principles: nutrient density, comprehensive nutrient adequacy, hormonally favorable, and avoiding toxins and chemicals. Pretty straightforward, right?
I think so, and I've seen it work for millions of people, and that's why I'm very pleased to have your voice in our summit and your message reaching ever more people. In the third one that you mentioned, hormones, you talked about keeping IGF-1 levels down, being a very important health thing to do. In the anti-aging clinics that are fairly widespread in the country today, very often they sell and market human growth hormone as an anti-aging, help people keep young. And the way they register the effectiveness of this very expensive medication is through raising IGF-1 levels. The higher the IGF-1 level, the more they say the human growth hormone is working. So they're actually shooting for something that you are saying is absolutely to be avoided.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say that I don't really have a particular predetermined agenda or anything. I'm just trying to go with the evidence, the preponderance of evidence. And, you know, we could talk about a few studies to look at, you know, how many people were in the studies. They followed 85,000 people for 20 years. So we're talking here about looking at the evidence. And I know people like to get instantaneous results. They like to see the fat go off their body or their muscles increase. And I'm trying to say to people, look, if something can do something to you that quickly, it's having a pharmacologic effect. You don't get something for nothing without paying a price. So the bottom line is we have to keep two things in mind. Number one, that when these studies are done, they track people for many years. We have to follow people usually more than 10 years. And as it goes from 15 to 20 years, it's going to have even better results to see whether it's safe or not. And we have to have a lot of people in the study, too. So let's look at some of the data from these studies that do have a lot of people in them and track them adequately and see what the results show. So like one, for example, there's a study that followed 6,000 people. It was published in the medical journal Cell Metabolism in 2014, just this year, and they followed them for 18 years. Now, these people in the 50 to 65 age range who were followed for these 18 years had a fourfold increase in cancer death comparing people that ate about 25% of calories from animal protein compared to those that had less than 10%. And that's one study, okay? So just put that aside for a minute and go to the next study, which followed 43,000 women for 15 years, and noted for the very large number of participants, and they rated these people on whether they were on a high-protein diet or a low-protein diet. And, you know, all the people that were followed for the 15 years were all recommended they didn't eat sugar, or either, like, they all were recommended not to eat a high-sugar diet. So whether they had more vegetables or more animal protein, none of them were on a high-sugar diet, but they followed them for 15 years. And those that had a low-carb, high-protein score, they adhered better to the low-carb, high-protein. That's like in, you know, a lot of people advocate, paleo people, Atkins, Dukan, you know, the popular diets. They found a 60% increased risk of cardiovascular death. So it was consistent, it was gradual, increasing risk, and their conclusion was those are dangerous. And I can go on, you know, to the next study that followed 85,000 women now and 4,400 men for 20 years. Another third study also published in the last few years that were followed. We're talking about following, you know, more than 125,000 people for, you know, more than 20 years, an average of 26 years in women, showed a more than a 23% increased risk of death from all causes. So the only fly in the ointment here, a person could be critical of these studies, they could say that, well, they're not looking at people over the age of 70 who already are starting to get frail and less muscle utilization of tissue. And those people weren't followed for 20 years because those people, when they're older, starting to get frail, and they're losing muscle tissue, at that point, maybe giving them more animal protein or even more hormones may have some beneficial effect to promote longevity. Because being the devil's advocate, those studies didn't study those very elderly people, and there's some indication, the scientific literature, that elderly, frail people do benefit from higher protein in their diet or could even benefit from growth hormone. But, you know, but my findings and the findings from epidemiologic studies show that when you eat healthy, we're talking about the nutritarian approach, which is high in micronutrients. We have a lot of high-nutrient plant foods like greens and beans and nuts and seeds. And, you know, we're trying to get more protein. The nutritarian diet I recommend already is very protein-favorable. We're favoring plant protein over animal protein for many different reasons that we can discuss. And we're noting that the 70-year-olds and the 75 and 80-year-olds aren't becoming frail. They're not losing muscle mass. They're not losing athletic performance. And they can't be equated with the 75-year-old who's been on an American diet and who's getting frail and the body is aging more rapidly and degenerating. So I would think that even in those cases, you wouldn't need to push up protein higher as they're aging because they're not aging as rapidly and getting the same effects from a person who's already been eating more of a standard diet. Do you follow me?
I think so. I hear you saying that the preponderance of evidence from long-term studies indicates that high-protein diets, though they may help people lose weight in the short term, end up greatly increasing heart disease risk and cancer risk, that you can lose weight on them, but they're not healthy ways to do it. And I also hear you saying that when people follow the nutritarian principles that you advocate, that you're outlining here, they get plenty of protein, and it's a favorable kind of plant protein. And one more thing I hear you saying is that when people eat the kinds of foods you advocate, they age differently. They aren't as frail. They retain muscle mass and athletic performance. And in general, they age more slowly. And as a result, they don't have the same protein needs as a person who's been eating the standard American diet might have. Joel, as I've been listening to you talk about the health advantages of plant protein versus animal protein, I'm remembering a photo I saw recently of you wearing a t-shirt with the pithy message on it, kale is the new beef. Now that's quite an evocative phrase. What does it mean to you, and why are greens so very important?
Well, that's right. You know, we joke around, and, you know, it's like we talk about kale and that Whole Foods and sale of kale have gone through the roof, and kale manufacturers should start paying me a consulting fee or something because I've sort of promoted their products over the years, you know, and the sales have gone up. But the point is we're talking here about dark green vegetables, and we're finding out from more and more scientific literature of the last 10 years, you know, the advances in nutritional science are showing that our immune system is intimately associated with the consumption of green vegetables, and without adequate intake of green vegetables, we cannot have a normal immune system. And I'm saying that the green vegetables also accelerate repair mechanisms that help reverse atherosclerosis if you've eaten poorly for the first half of your life, and they also prevent atherosclerosis from developing more effectively than other foods. So we're talking here about the effects of greens, and when I talk about G-bombs in general, G-bombs, of course, are G-B-O-M-B-S, greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds. I'm identifying that some natural plant foods have more powerful anti-cancer effects than others do. You know, it's people eat a diet high in plant food vegetation. They think they're not going to get cancer, and they probably won't. But if you want the most protection, we're finding out from the scientific literature that some foods are more protective than others. And we want people to be aware and to eat those foods adequately in their diet to get maximum protection.
Yes, we do. But people who eat a basically healthy diet, exercise regularly, and don't smoke might not realize they still have a cancer risk. The truth is that those of us who have eaten poorly for some portion of our lives, or even have had prenatal exposure to toxic influences, already have damaged cells that elevate our cancer risk. And even the healthiest diet cannot completely protect us from the onslaught of carcinogens we are exposed to in our environment today. So what I hear you say is that if we really want to become as cancer-proof as possible, we would do well to include the foods you call G-bombs in our diet: greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds. These are the foods that are going to accelerate DNA repair and enhance immune function, and these are the foods that help the body to optimally detoxify.
that's where a Nutrigen diet shines, is that enables to give people a way of eating that's going to maximize the disease reversal tendencies, to not just lower the risk of getting disease, but actually reverse the disease to get well from their asthma, to get rid of their fibromyalgia, to get rid of their lupus or psoriasis, to help them really reverse heart disease most effectively, get rid of their type 2 diabetes completely, so they don't need medication at all, not just improve it, but really get rid of it, and to really maximize the reduction in cancer rates, even if a person hadn't eaten so healthily for the first half of their life. So they know that it is helpful to have some raw cruciferous green vegetables every day. And it is helpful to have some raw onion every day. And eating seeds like flax seeds and chia seeds is important. And eating berries in your diet on a regular basis, a pomegranate to get those polyphenols, is important. So, in other words, we're helping people develop a diet that's more therapeutically effective and can also push the envelope of human longevity. And these things do make a difference because food is the best medicine. For example, you know, and I obviously I'm not just making claims, I'm building this out of the studies of the advances in modern nutritional science. Even a recent study came out about flax seeds that showed that just taking in flax seeds on a standard diet, when the person was given 30 grams of flax seeds a day, so their blood pressure was high, it lowered 15 points in 6 months, just from the flax seeds. And my recent survey of a few thousand people who follow my program found the average person that had high blood pressure, and we tracked them over the years, that their systolic blood pressure lowered 25 points. And that was 25 points in lowering their blood pressure while their medications were being removed and being taken off. So we're saying here that the average blood pressure medication lowers your blood pressure like 5 to 7 points compared to flax seeds, more effective, diet styles much more effective, and some of these medications obviously have increased risk of breast cancer or increased risk of having falls. We're talking about all types of needless risk, they're not as effective. So with your question, efficacy, safety, and obviously long-term good health, it's all in favor of eating right and excellent nutrition, not just good nutrition.
Joel, I want to ask you to explore a thought experiment with me. If everyone fully followed the Nutritarian diet that you advocate, and if we all started it early enough in life, and if we remained active and didn't smoke and didn't overindulge in alcohol, and if we all got sufficient vitamin D, what do you think would happen to cancer rates in this country?
Well, I think cancer rates would drop more than 95%, just to give you a quick answer, because, and the reason I could say 95% is because if we compare the cancer rates in this country today to cancer rates in more primitive societies we have some records on, we're talking about primitive. I shouldn't even use the word primitive. Even cancer rates in societies from 30, 40 years ago, from, you know, Mozambique and Costa Rica, we're talking about areas of the world where eating differently than us, even like South Korea or areas of northern India. In other words, we can compare cancer rates in various populations. And you know, you wrote a book about this years ago. I think it was Healthy to 100. Was that what it was?
Yes.
Yeah. So if we look at populations around the world, the populations of whole countries with cancer rates 90% lower rates of breast cancer than we see in America today. And they're not eating so perfectly, but they did eat that diet, you know, most of their lives. So that's why they had those lower rates. Then we follow these countries over the years. Like, I even have data from the 1970s. That's only 30 years ago, 35 years ago, from the 1970s in South Korea, when they had 80% less breast cancer than we have in this country today. And I tracked their diet over those years and found now they have still somewhat less, but their breast cancer rates went up about 500% in South Korea when they added more oil, more sugar, more animal products in their diet. We can track what they did and how the cancer rate skyrocketed. But nevertheless, the point is that it's not radical, or me making an unsupported claim to say we can reduce cancer rates by 95%, if these countries that weren't even eating so well or perfectly could have had 90% lower rates of cancer than we have in America right now. So these people are saying, you know, that, oh, it's mostly luck, there's nothing you can do about it, or it's just all, it's mostly genetics. That's not what the literature or the science suggests. And then if we combine that with the studies on people who are high consumer of green vegetables, look at those studies. Look at the studies of people who eat more nuts and seeds or flax seeds, or studies of people who live on breast cancer. For example, a study with women that ate more lignans had a 71% decreased death from breast cancer from women who were already diagnosed with breast cancer followed for 10 years, who had some lignans in their diet, had a 71% lower risk of death than those who had no lignans in their diet. The point that I'm making is I think I could make this argument with sound logic and sufficient evidence that it's not unreasonable to expect that we could win the war on cancer, easily wipe out 90%, most probably, like you said, if we started early enough in life, if we got the whole population to do it from, you know, childhood, then we certainly could wipe out 95% of the common cancers we see in this country.
Starting in childhood is a major factor, and those of us who have not eaten well for most of our lives can sometimes say, well, the damage is done. I'm now this age, I'm middle-aged, or whatever the number of years the Earth has gone around the sun. I'm well into my life, and I've been following probably less than optimally healthy practices, and my diet has not been very good, and I'm reaping the consequences, but I'm so entrenched in that, it's hard to change. And also, I wonder, will it do any good, given the extent of what I've already done to myself? And so sometimes people are lethargic and passive and resigned, and they don't think that making the changes at that age that they're at now will make any difference. What do you say to these people?
Well, you know, food is tremendously addicting. And people always come up with rationalizations and excuses why it's too late for them. They don't like the taste. They travel too much. You know, they've done it wrong so far. They've failed in the past. They've have all these rationalizations. You know, I think those thoughts are mostly their delusional part of their brain, their self-defeating part of their brain talking, because it is stressful to change, for people to change. And the body wants to reduce stress and anxiety. You know, part of the brain wants the status quo, doesn't want the discomfort of, you know, retraining the taste buds or learning to cook a new way or learning to get rid of food addictions, or they mostly want to just give up and smoke cigarettes, do whatever they've done wrong, stay, you know, on their couch potato self, eat whatever they've eaten. And it's really, I don't consider that a legitimate argument. It's like saying, I smoked cigarettes for 20 years, so I'm not going to quit because I already smoked for 20 years. I'll just keep smoking until I die. You know, we're not going to bring the smoker's risk back to zero from not having smoked for 20 years. But for every year they're off cigarettes, their risk of getting lung cancer or a premature heart attack goes down, and their risk of dementia goes down for the earlier life they quit. The same thing is true with whether you eat right or wrong. I mean, you're not going to bring the risk to zero, but the risk drops tremendously. And that's more of a reason to advocate what I do, because there's a million other doctors who have different viewpoints and different diet books and different recommendations, and I'm looking at those and I'm going and say, I guess they're appealing to a broader audience. They want to give people what the people want to eat. And my approach is to start on the opposite end. I don't start from what people want to hear, want to eat, what'll sell the most books. I want to describe what's the very, very ideal, the gold standard to maximize lifespan and therapeutic effectiveness. And then we could say, okay, now how could we get to use our brains and get the best chefs, scientists, experienced people, and see how we can make the healthiest diet taste great? And can we make it taste good and make people love it? And the answer is yes. You know, people love eating this way. I certainly do, and millions of people do in this who love eating this way because they develop a taste for it. They enjoy it. They like eating good-tasting food they know is good for them, too. And they recognize that even if in life we can't get 100% protection from what we did earlier, like with regard to cancer rates, if we ate unhealthy for the first 60 years or something, we still know we're doing the best we can do. And we're going to live our life without fear, with avoidance of medical interventions, and recognize that we are in control of our health destiny. We can't buy good health with better health care coverage. We can't look for better physicians to do it. We know that we're responsible for our own health outcomes, not pills, not medicines, not surgeries. And frankly, I want to avoid being tortured and having surgeries and medications and treatments and having limbs and body parts cut apart and cut open and tubes put in the orifices of your body. And it's a much more peaceful life to take good care of your health and rely on your own good health habits to protect yourself, as opposed to putting your life in the care of the medical profession and to do that. I mean, it's a much more peaceful life. And just think of all the fear people have, especially women with all the testing and fear about breast cancer. So I think that, to answer your question now, I think that we can expect to have dramatic benefits even when started later in life, even if those benefits are not absolute.
Well, I love what you're saying, and I'm glad that you're saying it, and I'm glad that you're saying it often. And I also look around, and I see that junk food is everywhere. It's legal, it's cheap, it's socially accepted. Billions of dollars are spent every year marketing it to children. it seems to me that it's become the drug of choice for many of us. And when I call it a drug, I mean this literally. The science on food addiction has established now that many of the low-nutrient, high-calorie, intensely sweet and salty or fatty foods that make up the majority of the standard American diet produce the exact biochemical effects in the brain that are characteristic of substance abuse. And this has not happened by accident. The food industry employs what they call craveability specialists who literally design their food products to maximize their addictive nature. Joel, what happens to the dopamine reward system when people eat these foods?
Well, thanks, John, because obviously you're bringing up a very, very important point. And even though people are somewhat aware of this, they're not aware of the extent of the damage. And they're not aware of what's really going on. Otherwise, they would put up more of a fight. People aren't so protective of their sugar and their junk food because these foods are deadly and they're addicting and they do affect drug centers in the brain, like you're saying, and raise dopamine. But not only that, they also create tremendous withdrawal symptoms, which make us, you know, gotta go grab more food and gotta overeat. They make it so it's impossible to maintain your weight at a normal weight, and how you eventually obviously develop heart disease, cancer, or, you know, develop problems later in life if you're eating these foods on a regular basis. But that part, I think, that is becoming more generally accepted by people, but people don't know about the relation between processed food, junk food, and fast food to depression. There's a dose-dependent relationship. People who eat fast food twice a week have double the rate of depression.
That's a staggering statistic. People who eat fast food twice a week have double the rate of depression. I don't think people realize this.
And people don't know about the link between processed foods and aggressive behavior. They don't know that there's a link between processed foods and low nutrient intake to aggressive to criminal behavior. And the people in prisons, they don't know the link between poor success in school, intellectual ability, success on the job, happiness in life, satisfied with your family. We're talking about food as an addiction and processed foods being highly palatable and highly addictive and fast food, that these foods are tearing at the core of our American society, ruining families, ruining lives, creating a higher rate of childhood cancers, tremendously destructive when you look what's the potential would be available to modern society with modern advances without these foods. And so I'm actually writing a book on this that's going to be entitled Fast Food Genocide that talks about how destructive these foods are to the fabric of our society in all different aspects, how it affects children, how it keeps certain people in poverty for their lives and unable to advance and benefit from the opportunity we have in America because they're not being fed properly to take fully advantage of opportunities here. And they're led to, from eating poorly, they're led to more likely have more bad habits, even drug behavior or more criminal behavior because obviously their brains are not being well nourished. They're not given the opportunity to reach their full potential in life because of bad food choices.
I want to stop here for a moment and just digest what you've just said because I find it to be really important, powerful, and true. There is so much suffering that could be prevented with healthier food choices. It's poignant for me to hear you describe the many ways our toxic food system spills into just about every aspect of our lives. I think that if people became aware of the devastating consequences of eating poorly, if they understood the real costs of our addictions to fast food and to junk food, if they could see what this leads to, not only for themselves, but for their children, we would see a real food revolution. I so appreciate what you're saying. And if I can shift gears again here, there is a particular question that I would like to know your thoughts on. We've been talking a bit about the science of food addiction. Is there a relationship between the size of the blood glucose spike that's produced by a particular food and the size of the addictive drive it produces in the brain?
Yes, but keep in mind that we don't eat one food in a vacuum. We eat a meal or we eat foods together. So it really is a combination of factors which has to do with how fast and how much glucose enters the bloodstream or how high that rises, but also other factors that accompany that rise. Whether there are a lot of nutrients in the meal, whether there's a lot of fiber in the meal, whether there's phytates that bind toxic metals, or whether there's, in other words, It's a little bit more complicated than that, but it's certainly that is a major factor, one of the major contributory factors. But all these factors work synergistically and intermingle, because when you eat processed foods like French fries and ice cream, you're not just getting the high sugar load. You're also getting, you know, a high oil load, a high salt load, a high, you know, you're taking in MSG, you're taking in, there's a whole mixture of biochemical events that occurs in the body that promote disease, that magnifies the negativity of the higher glucose load. And likewise, you can minimize the negativity of foods by having a lot of healthier factors in the diet, that we can talk about too. But the point is, when you do good things together, it magnifies the benefits, and when you do bad things together, it magnifies their negatives. So certainly all these things come together, and I often make the joke, and I show people the way Americans are eating with this mixture of oil, sugar, processed foods, and high levels of animal protein, and then they're not getting the fiber, they're not getting the phytochemicals, they're missing the protective antioxidants, and I make the joke and I say, this diet couldn't be better designed had it been made by Al-Qaeda. It was funny because they wouldn't even let me say that joke on PBS. I was in my last PBS television show, and I went to say the joke, and they said, you can't say that. I said, well, am I offending? I'm worried about offending Al-Qaeda. So I had to change it to, this diet was designed by Darth Vader. I said, Darth Vader? That's not even funny. So it's kind of funny that I had to change my joke and make it into such a bad joke.
Well, it speaks to something that's far from funny, which is that our kids are being targeted by junk food ads. And if a foreign entity were doing to our children what the processed food, the junk food companies are doing to them, making them fat, making them sick, giving them diabetes, making it impossible for them to concentrate, reducing their attention span, making them hyperactive, making them depressed, making right. them feel bad about themselves, making it difficult for them to learn. If a foreign entity was doing that, we'd probably declare war on said entity. But instead, it's companies that actually have a lot of prestige and have gotten kids to demand their products, to nag their parents, to get them through the use of this marketing.
You know, I really agree with what you're saying, but part of me is also retorting back and saying, but kids don't drive a car. They don't turn the keys and go to these places and buy the food. The parents had to enable it. The parents have to permit it. And in most of these cases, the parents permit it because they're food addicts first, and they don't want to see themselves as food addicts, so they raise their child on the same diets they're eating. So it's a vicious cycle, because everybody's doing it. We just do it to our kids. But at some point in this process that's not ending, you know, we have to educate the adults to say, no way, Jose, that we're not going to have these foods in our house. We're not going to be going out to these fast food restaurants. We're not going to be eating processed sugars and white flour anymore. And they have to just have family meetings and decide what they're going to do. And the parents have to come up with certain, you know, rules for their family and say, we're not going all crossing this line, whatever that line may be, whatever they agree on. So I'm saying, and sure, we could blame the person selling the drugs, the fast food, the manufacturers, we could blame the industry, but I'm saying it has to start out where we have to get our population informed and just stop perpetuating this cycle of negativity. And we have to just have people change the way they eat and change the way their kids eat.
You know, I think you're making a really good point about families. I was in a home recently where the parents don't eat very well. They eat a lot of junk food, and there's a lot of soda pop that they drink, but right. they forbid it to their kids.
Wow.
So they're trying to get the kids to eat more healthfully, but there's soda pops all over the place, and the kids are seeing their parents and other adults consume it, and it's not working very well. In that family, the kids are rambunctious, and that's a nice way of putting it. They're actually belligerent, and they're being treated in a way that they don't respect, and they don't feel respected. And I think the point is that the whole family has to shift. I don't think you can say to a child, do as I say, but not as I do, and maintain credibility with that child.
Of course. It's completely hypocrisy. But the point, obviously, you know, we're in agreement on this, that, you know, I used to say, speak to the kids in the schools. And I'm saying, what? I speak to the kids in the schools, and then the parents object, and they feed them junk anyway. If I'm going to speak to a school, bring the parents in simultaneously, so I can speak to the kids and the parents at the same time, and then we can get something done, because the parents are going to sabotage whatever you tell the kids to do. But in any case, it's a problem in our society, and it is changing somewhat, but obviously more dramatic change is possible, and it's what we're all fighting for.
It is. And Joel, someone once said that the food you eat can either be the safest and most powerful form of medicine, or it can be the slowest form of poison. one of the things I'm grateful to you for is that you remind us all that every time we eat or drink, we're either strengthening our health or we are weakening it. And if it's true, and I think it is, that most people really have no idea how good their body is designed to feel, it's just as true that you have helped millions of people to know the joy of living in a truly healthy and vibrant body. On behalf of myself and of Ocean, and of everyone involved in the Food Revolution Network, I thank you for your tireless efforts to help each of us live our highest health potential.
Oh, thanks so much, John. That was very beautifully said and articulated, and I thank you for including me, being part of the wonderful work you're doing, and I really appreciate this opportunity.
We've been talking with Dr. Joel Fuhrman, author of many bestsellers, including The End of Dieting, and research director at the Nutritional Research Foundation. Joel, your work and your insights are a source of hope and of health for millions of people. We want to thank you for your passion, for your wisdom, for your research, for your eloquence, and for the huge impact that you're making in the lives of millions. We want to thank you also for your partnership in the food revolution and for joining us today.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources from our speakers and partners. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.